Okay, we're in here on the bottom of Lamed Gimel Amud Bet, seven lines from the bottom. Amar Rav Zvid, Hai Mani Dekunya, Chivara Va'ukma Shari, Yeroka Asur. So these utensils, clay utensils, that are glazed with molten lead, that's what Rashi describes them as. Although the Balei Tosafot have a slightly different view, thinking that it is, they're glazed with some sort of glass, glaze that's, so even though generally glass itself, we don't have any questions with regards to absorption and palate and its exuding of items and their kasher. Nevertheless, here with the glass glaze, because it's made from the same material as the kli cheres chol, it's made out of sand, and it's not fully baked or cooked in, so therefore it becomes porous like the kli cheres. So they speak about it as being a glass glaze, although Rashi speaks about it as being a molten lead glaze that was put on the item. Chivara ve'ukma, if they're white or black, shuri, then it's not a problem. Yeroka, asur. If it's green, then it's problematic. Mishum de mitzri. Because, again, Rashi describes it over here, it has these aluminum or alum crystals in it, and they are absorptive in nature, and that makes the glaze itself problematic. You had before kli machporet shel tzrif, which were mentioned in yesterday's daf. Over there, they spoke again, it's alum crystals, which are either made out of, it's hydrated potassium and aluminum sulfate, which are put together that give you this glaze, and if they are greenish in nature, that shows that the item has become more porous because of the metallic content of the item. So that is more absorptive. If it has cracks or crevices in it, then even if they're black or white, then they are problematic. Because then we feel that there are gaps in the glazing that makes it into a kli cheres. It could be that these kartufene are stakim in the kli itself, and ever the glaze doesn't reach into those areas. Or it could be that the glaze itself is not fully smooth across, and there are cracks in the glaze itself. And that means that the green ones would be asur completely, and the other ones would have a din like a kli cheres. That as long as it was used in cold storage, then it would be fine just to use the regular cleansing that you do for a kli cheres. So Dorash Mreimar, Konya ben Uchma ben Chivara ben Yeroka Shari. So here we have Mimreimar saying that this konya, no matter what color it is, white, black, or green, is fine. My shnami chametz bePesach. How is this different than the story by chametz and Pesach using these kelim on Pesach? Dubai Mimreimar, hani mani de konya, maudish temushehu bePischa. What's the story with using them on Pesach? So he says, Yeroka, loti bailach. If it's green, don't even ask the question. Demitzarfe, ubale. They have this aluminum or alum crystal, whether it's aluminum sulfate, whatever it is in there that is absorptive, and therefore there's no question that you can't use them because they have chametz in them. Vasire, ki dibaylach chivare v'ukme. By black and white ones, that's where you have your question. Might, what's the din there? Ki it behu kartufune lo tibaylach. Devadai bale vasire. If they have any crevices, cracks along the way, that's not a question either, because then they definitely absorb, and you have a problem. Kiti bailach deshi. The problem is if they're smooth, where you get a full glaze, there's no problem with the glaze at all. My, what's the din there? Amar lehu, ana chazina lehu, I've seen them demidaiti, that they exude or sweat. The kamen demidaiti, vadai bale, is since they are sweating or exuding the liquid, that means that they are porous by definition. So vadei bale, that means that they're absorbing, vasire, and that makes them problematic. So Rashi describes over here that there was liquid that was gathering on the outside of the utensil, which meant that there was some sort of porous nature to the material, because that's how the liquid was getting to the outside of the utensil. He says, well, if it gets to the outside, that means it goes through the middle too, and that it is porous and absorptive. So that's why it's problematic. My time up. What's the reasoning? Once you have absorption by an earthenware utensil, then there's no way to get it out of it forever, because the Torah says about kli cheres that there's no way to be mitaher them, there's no way to deal with them. That's why the Torah says, whenever it comes to kli cheres, yishaver, it's broken, or yutatz, by the tanur and kiran, they need to be broken or uprooted. So the only solution for kli cheres is to break them, and there's no tahara for kli cheres. That's why they think they identified where Mishkan Shiloh was, because all the mountainous areas around that area have broken shards of pottery, and we know that the din of Mishkan Shiloh is that you can eat b'chol ro'eh, anywhere you can see Mishkan Shiloh from, you're allowed to eat kodoshim. So anybody who finished their kodoshim, the kelim, the clay cheres, were broken afterwards because they had kodesh or kodeshim that absorbed in them, and they could not be reused after that point in time. They either have a problem of, if you're going to use them for kulin, that they have kodeshim absorbed in them, or even if you're going to use them for kodeshim again, you have a problem of notar. After the expiry date of the kodeshim, then whatever's absorbed in there now is notar. And so you couldn't use them anymore, and so they broke them. And that's what they found around the areas that they think is Mishkan Shiloh, tons and tons and tons of broken shards of pottery, which would have been exactly what the Torah describes. So, Maishnami Yayin Nesech, why is it different than Yayin Nesech? The Darsh Lumareim are Kulu Mane Du Kunya Shari. Over there he said all of these Kunya utensils are fine. So if you think that the issue is that chametz is an isur d'oraita, yayin nesech is only an isur d'rabanan. Now what you see here from the Gemara is even though we're speaking about stam yenam, if it was yayin nesech, it would be d'oraita also. So the Gemara uses that terminology, yayin nesech, even though it's not really yayin nesech. That's part of the chashash of stam yenam, is that they will make it into yayin nesech. We have mishum chatnot, the problem of intermarriage. That's one issue with Stam Yenam. The other issue is that it could be Yayin Nesech. We're afraid that he made it into Yayin Nesech. So here the Gemara is clearly using the term Yayin Nesech, referring to Stam Yenam and not the real Yayin Nesech. The real Yayin Nesech we asked right after the Mishnah. What's the source for that? And we brought Psukim Midoraita, which makes it sound like it's Nisu Doraita. Vaha. Even if you say it's Stam Yenam and it's Nisu Dorabanan, Kol Tikun Rabbanan Kein Doraita Tikun. They pattern it. They make the Dine Dorabanan follow something that you've seen in a din d'oraita. That's generally the case, even when we're dealing with dine d'rabanan that are pure dine d'rabanan. Lately, we've spoken about the difference between dine d'rabanan, which connect to an issue d'oraita, which is that they're either an extension or a preventative measure for a din d'oraita. And then you have dine d'rabanan, which are completely independent of any din d'oraita. But even so, no matter which din d'rabanan, they always try to find a paradigm which they are following. So even if you're going to say that there's a complete din d'oraita, they still want to find some sort of basis, min haTorah, for the structure of what they are using. The Briskers were very makbid about this, and that's why Rav Soloveitchik, when he spoke about Avelut in terms of Sfira and Avelut in terms of the 3 weeks, he wanted to claim that it had to be patterned after something else we find in Avelut, whether it is the Shiva, Shloshim, or Shana Rishona of Avelut, and therefore the dinim have to be equal or equivalent between them because it has to follow one of the patterns that already exists. They have that concept, but the Gemara speaks about it all the time, that Kol Tikun Rabbanan Kein D'oraita Tikun. The answer in the end is, Zetash Misho B'chamim, Zetash Misho B'shotonim. The simple difference is the utility of the item. When it comes to Pesach, and it comes to Chametz B'Pesach, we're speaking about these Mane Kunya that were used under conditions in which there was heat. And when you have conditions of heat, then the absorption is much more extreme, and therefore if they're used again under heat, they're going to be polite. They're going to exude whatever item is absorbed there, and that's what your problem is. When you use it in cold, then their absorption levels are very different. By the hot items, then when the glaze is sealed, we don't worry about it at all. But when the glaze is broken, we worry about it. And number two is, even when the glaze is not broken, if it's green, then you have a material that under heat will absorb. And that's why you have a problem with chametz. Yayin Nesach is always cold. So you're putting it in there, you're dealing with a cold item. With cold items, he says, Mani Dukunya doesn't really matter. So you can treat them in a way that's not problematic because they never are put under heat. And therefore, you don't have all these qualifications about what you can use and not use. And that's why Mereimar said there that all types of Mani Dukunya are fine. Right, so now, just a note here, the Balei Tosfot asks, why is the Gemara saying that you can never be metaher a kli cheres, or you can never kasher a kli cheres? Don't we have the Gemara just before said that you'd return them to the furnace? And if you refire the kli cheres, then it is metaher the kli cheres. So the Baal Tosfot says something very interesting. He says that, why don't we put it back in the furnace, and then you can be metaher it? Why is all this worry about never being doing that? He says, Omer Tam. When you refire it in the furnace, you're not kashering an existing kli, you are creating a new kli. You're restarting the whole process. This is not the same old kli, just with the absorption knocked out of it. This is a completely new kli, and it's like starting with a fresh start, and that's why it works. So that's why he says that the kivshuna work. Then he brings also from the Vishimcha Mishans, which is the Rosh Mishans, the Vadai Gabek Teirot Shocheres, Dein Tarkam Behesek, Kimach Zilu, Bikimshan, Shayach Lemeimar, Elu acherim heim. Says that's true when you're dealing with normal utensils or kli cheres. Those inside items, if you fire them in the furnace, they're considered to be brand new. But when it comes to tanur v'kiraim, when it comes to ovens and stoves that are made out of kli cheres, shusuram b'yidei hesek. The whole iser comes because they're fired up all the time. And you'd say bechazrat utam lekibshan el v'loni kli acher. And if you put it back in and fire it in the furnace, you haven't done anything. It's the same thing as cooking in it. And therefore, you haven't created a new kli. So he says that this dispensation to refire it, to make it into a new kli, only works when you're dealing with kli cheres that are utilized for eating in, storing in, or even possibly cooking in. But items that were used under heat, and that's the whole purpose, is to be under heat, like ovens and stoves, then when you refire them in the furnace, what have you done differently than their existence already? Now, the truth is, you could differentiate because there the heat is coming from the inside versus the firing in the furnace where it's coming from all around it on the outside. So you could argue against that view of the Rosh Mishnah, but he's trying to explain why the Torah says by the Kedorne Kirayim, you tats. It only gives you one option, which is you have to break them, and why doesn't it give you the option of refiring them in a furnace? And he says because they're different than regular clay cheres. Right, so now the Gemara continues here and says, Rabbi Kiva ikla leginzak. So Rabbi Kiva went to Ginzak, not clear where Ginzak is, but it seems to be that it's in northwestern Persia. And so that was Rabbi Akiva leaving Eretz Yisrael. Rabbi Akiva is based out of Eretz Yisrael. And we know that he does travel outside of Eretz Yisrael because we have situations in the Gemara where they want to be Ma'abar the Shonah and Rabbi Akiva is not around or he's in Chutz Laretz and they're doing the calculation in Chutz Laretz. So we know that he traveled both to the western side to Rome and also to the eastern side. I don't know if he got as far as Babel. It's not clear where he went to. But here he went to Ginzak. Because of the nature of the story, Rashi and Tanit says that you can't be Goris Rabbi Akiva, and the Bali Tosfos will bring that over here. Because he says, Chatz v'shalom, that Rabbi Akiva didn't know the answer to these questions. Because the Gemara is going to ask a series of questions where Rabbi Akiva doesn't know the answer. Rashi says, that can't be. Rabbi Akiva, the Gdolei HaTalmidei Chachamim, could not be the one who didn't know the answer to such a question. And therefore, Rashi changes the Girsa to Mar Ukva. Kiva Ukva sounds similar, and there are others who have a Girsa of Rabbi Akavya. So those are other versions of the story to eliminate Rabbi Akiva from the story, because Rashi places it on the problem of the questions that are asked and doesn't know the answer. Others just base it on the fact that they're not sure that we ever know that Rabbi Akiva reached a place like Ginzak, which was far away from any Jewish center. Why would Rabbi Akiva have been in such a location? And for that reason, they think that it might have been someone else. But given that, Rabbi Akiva Iklad Ginzak, Baumine, these are the questions they asked of him. Mitanim l'shaot, or in mitanim l'shaot? Can you have a fast, or partial day fast, or can you not? Lo v'biyodeh, he didn't know. Kankanim shel obdei kochavim asurim o mutarim. When it comes to these clay cheres of the obdei kochavim, are they mutar asur? Lo v'biyodeh, he didn't know. Bamet shimesh Moshe, kol shivat yimei hamiluim. What was the garment that Moshe used during the Shivat Yemei HaMiluim? Here we're reading the Parshiyot HaMishkan now. For the first 7 days in the Miluim, Moshe served as the Kohen or Kohen Gadol, and Aaron Ubanav were the Baalim of the Korbanot, but they were the props in the setup of the Miluim until they became the Kohanim. We'll discuss each one of these items in a second. Lo Avi B'Yodeh. He didn't know the answer to it. So that's why Rashi doesn't like this being Rabbi Akiva, because here we have three different halachot that seemed pretty straightforward, and across Shas, and to say that Rabbi Akiva didn't know the answer to all three of these questions seems unusual. Ata sha'al Beit Midrasha, so he went to the Beit Midrash to find out. Amrei hilchata mitanim l'sha'ot. Halacha is that you can't have a partial day fast. V'mishlim mitpalel tefillat tanit. And he finishes off the fast, then you can say aneinu in your davening. What mitanim l'sha'ot is very difficult to know. Part of the problem is based on a memra of Shmuel and Tanit, who says that any tanit that you're not mitkabel the day before, any tanit that you don't accept on yourself at mincha the day before, is not called a tanit. So here, how do you have a tanit where there's no kabbalat tanit beforehand? So that's what many of the Rishonim are dealing with. We'll start with Rashi's interpretation, then move to Baal Tosfot, give three or so different options as to what this is. And obviously these have implications about the type of fast that we take today. So first of all, Rashi says, L'shaot, kagon. He took upon himself a fast afternoon. But he didn't taste anything. It just happened to be that he skipped breakfast that day, and he was so busy that by the time lunch rolled around, he realized he hadn't eaten a thing. He says, you know what? Got through half a day. Why don't I finish out the day and have it be a fast day for me? So he accepts the second half of the day as being a fast. The first fast for the day was just happenstance. Just happened to be that he was fasting because he didn't eat. And now he wants to continue and finish off the day in a fast. That's what Rashi says happens over here. And then the next statement of the Gemara then is part and parcel of it, which is in Mishlim. If that's what he does and he finishes off the day, then mitzvalot tfilat tanit. Then you're allowed to daven aneinu, even though the beginning of the fast was not a Kabbalah. It just happened. Nevertheless, since you were mekabel the second day and you're finishing off the fast, as a fast day, you can daven tfilat aneinu. So Tosfot over here brings up the issue, the Gemara and Tanit, about Shmuel and having Kabbalat Tanit. According to Rashi, the Kabbalat Tanit happens in the middle of the day. How do you have a Kabbalat Tanit for the same day, in the middle of the day? That doesn't work. So Balei Tosfot Zayir, Tzarech Lamar Demari, Nami Shekibel Alav Mietmol. The case where the Kabbalah was yesterday. Shin. And it's a conditional Kabbalah, which is a very interesting concept. He says, Shimlo Yochal Machar Ad Chatzi Hayom. He says, listen, if I don't eat the first half of the day, then the second half of the day, I'm going to fast. So Tosafot solved the problem by making the Kabbalah the day before, and it's conditioned on what the morning's like. If I don't eat in the morning, then I'm going to fast the remainder of the day. If I do it in the morning, then I'm not going to fast the remainder of the day. And so there creates a conditional Ta'anit, which is triggered by whether he does or does not eat in the morning. And that's what he calls Tanit Sha'ot. And that way, he accomplishes that Kol Tanit Shalok Yivalav Mibol Jom Lo Shmei Tanit. He gives another option. Inami, Ika the Meimar, the Marinami Zalok Yivalav Meitmol, case where he didn't have a Kabbalah from yesterday, the Mashma Lashon Imloch Imluche, Bahad Abai Shmol Kabbalah Hi Lechatkhila. The fact that Shmol requires you to make a Kabbalah the day before, that's only Lechatkhila. Bisham in the Darin Parish, Kona Mefresh Mitanim Lashot Shimachalat Chatzi Ayom, the case here is a case where he ate for the first half of the day. And then in the second half of the day, he decides, I want to fast. So as opposed to Rashi, where he didn't eat the first half of the day, and he says, I just finished off the day in a fast, here it's literally, it's a half-day fast. And half-day fast is a case where he ate in the morning, and then halfway through the day, he decides to have a Kabbalat Tanit, and finish off the day with Tanit. That's what the Tosfot says. Maybe Shmuel didn't only lechatchila, but the Abad, you can't create a Tanit in this way, which is, you eat the first half of the day, halfway through the day, you say, listen, I want to fast the remainder of the day, and that works. Or, you have another possibility, which is, a case like Rabbi Yochanan, where Rabbi Yochanan was giving shir, and during the time period of the shir, he said, we're not going to eat until I finish the shir. So there is something literally, mitanim l'shaot, which is that he's in the middle of giving shir, and he wants to finish the shir, and he says, I won't eat until I finish this year. So he wants to encourage himself to finish up and to be done so that he can eat. So there it's not clear that he had a Kabbalah or when the Kabbalah happened and when it is during the day. And that leads other Rishonim, like the Raivin and others, to suggest that the situation here is where he was Mekabbalah fast for the first half of the day and only until noontime, which is that he took a Kabbalah to fast from the morning until the afternoon or to Mincha time. And then he says, after that, I'm going to break the fast. So here you have three or four different views as to what mitanim l'sha'ot is. Either like according to Rashi is where you started fasting by accident and then you continue and finish off the day. Balei Tosfot, we have a Kabbalah al tanai, which is that if I do fast the first half of the day, I'll have the second half of the day. Both those are the instances you end up fasting the whole day. And that means that im yishlim, if you finish it off, then you say tfilat tanit. The other two versions are that either you eat the first half of the day and then fast the second half of the day, or you fast the first half of the day and then eat the second half of the day. So that's literally mitanim l'sha'ot. You have a half day fast, literally. And then hishlim might be a totally different halacha, which is that when you finish the fast, that gives you the right to say tefillat aneinu, which would then preclude you from saying tefillat aneinu in these half day fasts, because lo hishlim, you didn't finish off the day. If you read the word hishlim that way, you could read the word hishlim means that you got to the end of the day. That means that a fast on the second half of the day would require aneinu. The first half of the day would not. And then we had this other version of Rabbi Yochanan, which sounded like in the middle of the day. You could have a tanit l'sha'ot for a period of time or a certain amount of duration, which was that he said, during the shir, I'm going to have this fast. And the question is, do you get schar as if you're fasting? Because the Kabbalah gives you the schar like you're fasting for a particular purpose. Without the Kabbalah, just because you don't eat, doesn't mean that you are fasting. They're two different things. Not eating just means that you're on a diet, that you haven't consumed food, but it has no religious significance to it, the fact that you're not eating. In order for not eating to be something of religious significance, you need a Kabbalah. You need an acceptance that shows that you're not eating for a particular purpose, so that you're not just, sometimes it happens that a person is so busy, they don't eat that whole day. Does that mean they fasted? No, it just means they didn't eat that day. So when you want to fast, you need a Kabbalah. And that's really the issue that they're trying to grapple with here is, where's the Kabbalah that makes it into a fast? And so Shmuel says you need to have that Kabbalah the day before. Rabbi Tosafot is suggesting, if you say that's binding, then you can only have it where you remember Kabbalah the day before. That's not binding. I mean, it's only the Chatchila, b'diavad. You can create it, and you can have a Kabbalah in the middle of the day, or at the start of the day, or a Kabbalah for half a day. But in the end, you need some form of Kabbalah that gets you through it. The Rabbeinu Tam suggests over here, Masebir lifnei Rabbeinu Tam, Be'achad shasar ve'taniyot v'lo kiblei me'etmol. A guy had fasted numerous fasts, but he had never accepted them the day before. So this guy didn't eat. Day after day after day, he was fasting. I don't know, say he fasted every Monday and Thursday. He fasted every Monday and Thursday, but he never made a Kabbalah the night before, or the mincha before, in order to fast on those days. It's not that he just didn't eat. They are considered to be fast days, a religious significance. Since he had in mind to fast, hainu gamar bilibo. That's the equivalent of having a gamar leiv, v'avi bichlau nidib leiv. That's part of being like somebody that you consecrate or you donate. Damar gamar b'libo. Nadiv leiv means someone who came to the conclusion in his heart that he wanted to do this. Afo pishlo tzi bisfatav. Even though he doesn't articulate it. Even though he didn't articulate it, since he had the intent to fast on these days, it's the equivalent of a Kabbalah. And that which Shmuel and Rabbi Yochanan say that if you were not the Kabbalah, that's only the Chatchila. Rodayahu meri rotam. Ki af lo gamar b'libo ad alayla. Even if he didn't conclude this until nighttime, he can still fast. And here's your question. Here's a personal fast where you say, Aneinu. It's the equivalent of discharging your obligation as if you accepted it the day before. He didn't have definitive proof to what he was saying. Obviously, the best way to do it is at Mincha. You can see in many Sidurim, they have, by the Elokai Nitzor, they have the Lashon, or the language for accepting a Tanit the next day, that you can say, I agree, I need to kabel alai Tanit, l'machar, and that is B'tfilat Mincha. That we do, if you remember, when you do Hatarat Nidarim before Rosh Hashanah, one of the things that you accept, EX, accept, from the Hatarat Nidarim, is Chutz Min HaTanit, Shinem Bekabel Mizman HaMincha. That if I take a nether to accept the tanit, bizman ha-mincha, that is binding. Even though there you make a declaration that any nether that I make will be null and void up front, and it's not accepted. Over there, one exception to that rule is accepting a tanit, bishat ha-mincha. And that's based on this principle that you need to accept it the day before. Rabbeinu Tam is willing to extend that and say, even if he did it in his head, and even he did it at night. And it's interesting, Rabbeinu Tam says, I have no proof to this, but my gut tells me that if you do it the night before and you accept it, that's enough. But I don't have any evidence to that. And the Ri had a problem, which is that he used to fast sometimes on Sunday. How do you have Kabbalat Tanit on Shabbat for Sunday? So Ri, Ayar Ragil, Yemitaneh Bechad B'Shabbat, Kabel Tanito, B'Shabbat V'Elokai Nitzor. In Elokai Nitzor on Shabbat at Mincha time, he used to accept the Tanit and take the Neder about Sunday. So even though it was Shabbat, he was still Mekabel the Tanit at Mincha on Shabbat. Alright, so now, according to the different reasons that we saw here, according to Rashi, imishlim is a continuation of the previous statement, which is if he finishes off the day, b'tanit, he could say aneinu. According to the other reasonings, then it could be either a part of it, like Tosafot says that was out tonight, or it could be something completely separate, which means imishlim, if you finish off the fast day, if you fast the day, then you're allowed to say aneinu. If you don't finish the fast, you're not allowed to say aneinu. That's what brought up the practice that we only say aneinu at tefillat mincha. Because by the time Mincha rolls around, we assume the person's going to make it through the fast. We don't say Aneinu in Maariv the night before, Shacharit the morning, because there's a risk that the person may not finish off the fast, and then it would be like as if a person's lying against Filah, which we don't want. So we wait until then to say Aneinu. Now that does lead to an interesting issue, which is not the topic of our case over here, but the Mishonim speak about the possibility of saying Aneinu the night before, even though it was not a 24-hour fast. So some of the Rishonim say, what are you talking about? There's no Aneinu in Maariv because you're not fasting yet. You don't start fasting at Shacharit and Mincha. But there are others, Rashi and Mar Shabbat, which he brings to the name the Gonim, and also the Bava Mor discussed the possibility of Aneinu at Maariv the night before, which is this concept that was developed by Rav Soloveitchik with regards to Yom HaTani. Even though someone may only be fasting during the day, the day, in the greater sense, night and day, is a Yom Tanit. It takes on a status of Yom Tanit. And for that reason, he said that it's no question that the 3 weeks start on the night of Shiva Esar B'Tammuz. Even though Shiva Esar B'Tammuz, the fasting only starts in the morning, the 3 weeks start from the night before, because it is already the Yom Matanit. In cases where it's Nidche, where it's on Shabbat, and then you push it off to Sunday, there's no question, because then it's already Yudchet. By the time you get there, that's not the question. It's in a regular year, we have Yudzayin B'Tammuz. Moshe Feinstein reluctantly was matir. If someone got married on the night of Shiva Esar B'Tammuz before the fast day, that was already before the 3 weeks, he's not so into it. But he says in an emergency situation, Rav Soloveitchik was completely against it because of this concept of Yom HaTanit. Even if you only fasting during the day, the whole day takes on a Shem Tanit, and that means the 3 weeks start from the beginning of Shiva Esar B'Tammuz and not in the morning, which is generally the practice that we have today. I don't know of anybody who ever got married on the night of Shiva Esar B'Tammuz. The other thing that Baal HaTosafot will deal with is something, again, that's from the Gemara in Tanit, which is, when does a fast end? The Gemara says, Kol Tanit shelo shaka la v'chama. Any Tanit that the sun doesn't set on is not a fast, meaning that the sun setting seems to be the end of the fast, and not Seita Kochavim. And so the Baal HaTosafot are perplexed for why we wait to Seita Kochavim. Says, why do we wait until that time, even though it seems to be fine by Shkiyat HaChama? We don't want to get involved in a Safek, because we don't know Ben HaShemashot, when exactly Ben HaShemashot ends. They're here working with Rabbeinu Tam. So Rabbeinu Tam, you have 72 minutes after Shkiyah is Seita Kochavim, and about 12 and a half to 18 minutes before that 72-minute time is the second Shkiyah for Rabbeinu Tam. So you have a period of time in there where you have a safek or a large safek. Vod, the Shema Lashon Shaka. Or maybe when it says the sun set, it's Olomar Shaka L'Gamrei. It fully set. Again, this goes to Rabbeinu Tam Shita, that there's a Shkiyah Techama is when the sun moves off the horizon. That's Shkiyah Rishonah. And then there's the second Shkiyah when it gets dark out, when the sun's light is no longer visible. And so there are two Shkiyot, and those two Shkiyot are about 54 to 60 minutes apart in their timing. And so that would also mean that we're much closer to Seita Kochavim. Mi amitaneh erev Shabbat, a person who fasts on erev Shabbat, even though in halacha mitaneh mashlim, you finish it off, in tzerich ledaktek lavdim ad Seita Kochavim. You don't have to wait all the way until Seita Kochavim when you first have fasting on a Friday. Once you cross through Shkiyat, enough. And that brings you to other issues about when exactly fast days end, and that's why people are many times makil with regards to Seita Kochavim, with fast days, because of the fact, number one, they're derabban on many of them, and number two is because of this issue that really it sounds like from the Gemara, they're over at Shkia and not at Seita Kochavim, and therefore you find people being much more makil with regards to fast days. So then the next halacha is, Ve'ilchata kankanim shel Ovdei Kochavim la'achar Yud-Bet Chodesh mutarim. When it comes to Klei Cheres, Ovdei Kochavim, if you wait 12 months, where they're not being used, then they are fine, that they lose their status of having any time in them after the 12-month period. But what did Moshe use during that period of time of the 7 days when they were consecrating the Mishkan and putting it into service? B'chaluk lavan, he wore a white tunic. Ravkana matne b'chaluk lavan shembo imra. It was a white tunic that had no seam on it. So Rashi over here says, imra, safa, means a seam. Yeshomer shlo yachshdua, Shisambach Mishmata Mishkan. Some people say, like the Kohen Gadol, or those that worked with the Chumata Lishka, that they didn't have any seams or pockets, because they didn't want anybody to be choshed, that they took money, or they stole money, and they could put it somewhere. So now, some say that's the same thing by Moshe. There was no seam, so nobody could say that he put the money of the Mishkan in there. So he says, V'lov Milta, Rashi rejects it outright, and says it can't be, because the Avodat Mishkan was done already. All the donations, everything that was given is done, because the Mishkan's going into service now. So what are they worried about Moshe stealing? Everything's already done and made into whatever it was. So that can't be the reason that Moshe wore it. But Rashi doesn't do is give you the reason that he did wear it in this way. Why did he wear a tunic that was white? So here, the Baal HaTosafot bring a number of reasons as the possibility as to why it is that Moshe, first of all, had to wear a white tunic. And number two is, why didn't it have a seam on it? The Baal HaTosafot start out with that Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't use the big day kuna, because Rashi explains that by the big day kuna, it says, la'aron achicha. It's for Aaron and not for you. So a zar can't use them. He says, that doesn't make so much sense, because there is a gemara we're going to get to in Zvachim that says Moshe Rabbeinu was a Kohen Gadol for the whole 40 years they were in the Midbar. So what exactly did he do during the whole 40-year period? He must have been using the big day kuna gedola. So either you have to say that these Gemarot are bestira, that this Gemara doesn't agree with that view, that Moshe was the Kohen Gadol, or you could possibly explain that he used the Imra, this Chaluk, Lavan, that he used the whole time. He used it for the whole 40 years, not just for the 7 days. But then he says, during the Shivat Yemelim Davka, maybe the question comes up, not because of the other years, maybe during the other years he did wear the Big Day Kuna. The question about the Shivat Yemelim was that the Big Day Kuna were yet to be consecrated. They're only consecrated once they go into service in the 8th day. For the first 7 days, there weren't Big Day Kuna in a sense. And that's why Moshe Rabbeinu needed something else. Barav Yaakov Orleans Parish, Dafila Nitkadshu, even if they were already sanctified, every day of the Zayin Yemei Milim, they set up the Mishkan, take it apart. Set it up, take it apart. Yachshav kamo bagma. It was considered like a bama gedola. There ain't big day kuna be bama gedola. And there's no need for big day kuna on a bama gedola. And that's what solves the problem now. You have a bama gedola, you don't need big day kuna, because big day kuna are associated specifically with the Mishkan or the Mikdash. But then Tosfot runs into a problem because you're not allowed to bring a chatat on a bama gedola, and the chatat was one of the korbanot that were brought as part of the miluim. So the Baalei Tosfot say over there, that chatat was strange anyway. Because that's a chatat that wasn't eaten, but was burnt. And so when do we ever find a chatat chitzonah that's burnt? So it's already a type of chatat that we never find. So it'll also have another exception, that it was brought on a bama gedola. That's how the Baalei Tosfot deal with Moshe wearing a chaluk lavan. It's because he couldn't wear the big day kehuna, either because they weren't sanctified, or it wasn't necessary because it was a bama gedola, or because Moshe Rabbeinu was never really a Kohen or Kohen Gadol. He's only servicing during this period of time. Shembo Imra, now the fact that it doesn't have a seam on it, the Baalei Tosfot say, Fikach lo yabo Imra, v'fish zaya nikar yoter chadash. The reason it have a seam on it is so people know that it was a brand new tunic. Because the big day kuna have to be made specifically for use as Kohanim, and it can't be used by a hedjot beforehand. Can't go into the closet and find a nice white tunic and then bring it in and use it as the beged kuna. So how do they demonstrate that Moshe was wearing a brand new beged? Didn't have a seam on it, so that shows you that it was brand new. Or even so that he won't make the mistake to think that he was a Kohen and that he really is a hedjot. So they made a beged that doesn't simulate or has something strange about it, so people would know that he's not a Kohen. That's one way that they deal with it. The other way that they deal with it is very interesting, which is that Rav Moshe Perish, Shalom Yamru Acharkach, Shishimesh Aaron. Moshe is going to get retired in this process, and then Aaron's going to come back and fill in. So that people say, you know, what was wrong with Moshe? Maybe there's a moment Moshe, there's something wrong with Moshe, because he was doing it, and why did they switch to Aaron? So the answer is they didn't put a seam on it. If you don't put a seam on a beged, what happens to the beged? What's the purpose of a seam on a beged? It's to hold it together. You have the weave, and then the weave at the end, you can knot it and try to hold it in place. But what the seam does is seals the weave in place so the weave doesn't unravel. So when you don't put a seam on there, what you're basically saying is that this is not a long-term beged. It is only for short-term usage. And that's why they didn't put a seam on it. It's so that people realize that Moshe was only doing this temporarily. He wasn't doing this full-time. And when they switch over to Aaron, it would be self-understood that Moshe was only doing this temporarily because he didn't have a seam on his beged, and the beged was only made for a short duration to be used during that 7-day period. And then he brings an alternate lashon, which is Shembo Imra with an ayin. Here it says Imra with an aleph, which we said was a seam, but if you read it, Imra with an ayin, Amar in Aramaic is wool. And what it said is it didn't have wool in it. It was a linen tunic without any wool, so there was no kilayim in it. Big Day Kahuna have kilayim in that. And what they're saying here is that Moshe's tunic did not have kilayim in it. Now, the only thing I want to note here is something, because it's coming up in the parashiyot that we're reading now, in Vayakel Pekudei, is that the Gemara only asks here about the first 7 days of the Miluim. What the Gemara does not ask about is the 8th day, which is Yom HaShmini, when the Mishkan goes into service. The problem is that Moshe Rabbeinu, according to Parashat Pekudei, is the Kohen Gadol, and is the one who does the service on the 8th day. And the issue is really subject to a Machlokt Rishonim in the Mefarshei Amikra, Rashi, the Rashbam, and the Ramban, and also has to do with the Girsaot in Rashi of Machloket about what Rashi actually wrote on Parshat Pekudei. And I'll send out the Mikorot, you can take a look at this issue. So how come the Gemara never addresses what Moshe wore on the 8th day of the Miluim, or really the Yom HaShmini, which is the first day of service of the Mishkan? So what you could answer is, he wore the white tunic, the same thing he wore for the first 7 days he wore on the 8th day. That's a little strange. Why don't they just say that it was 8 days and not 7 days? The other possibility is that the Torah has actually a contradiction in it. In Parshat Begudei, when we're speaking about the consecration of the eighth day, Moshe Rabbeinu is the Kohen Gadol. If you look in Vayikra, or if you look in Bamidbar, the Yom HaShmini, Aaron HaKohen is the Kohen Gadol there. There's actually a steer on the Torah as to who is the Kohen Gadol on that day. And truthfully, it's associated with the Sfarim. The Sefer Shmot, which is the Sefer of Moshe Rabbeinu, has Moshe Rabbeinu be the Kohen Gadol on the eighth day. Sefer Vayikra, which is dealing with the Kohanim, has the Kohen, or Aaron HaKohen, be the Kohen Gadol on the eighth day. So you actually have a stira between the Chumashim. It has to be reconciled, but it might have to do with the focus of that Chumash as to who is the one doing the service on the eighth day, and the question as to whether Moshe Rabbeinu on the eighth day actually did or did not serve as the Kohen Gadol, and maybe that's why the Gemara doesn't deal with the eighth day, because it's not clear that Moshe Rabbeinu was the Kohen Gadol on that day. Right now we hop back to our Mishnah. Our Chazanim Vazagim Shel Dei Kochavim. So back in our Mishnah we said that it comes to the skins and the pits of the pressed grapes of the Ovdei Kochavim, there's a difference between older ones and newer ones, or basically moist ones and dry ones. Tarabanan, ha-chatzanim ha-zagim shol Ovdei Kochavim, lachim asurim, if they're still moist, they're problematic. Yuveshim, if they're dried out, mutarim, then they're fine. Hey ninu, lachim, hey ninu, yuveshim. How do you know whether it's moist or dried out? Amar Yudah Meshmo, lachim kol yudbet kodesh. Lachim, or moist ones, are for the first 12 months after they've been pressed. Yivishim lachar yudbet kodesh. 12 months afterwards, they're so dried out to the point where they're no longer a problem of stam yenam, or no problems of what we worry about with regards to wine. Itmar, Amar Rabbi B'chan Rabbi Yochanan, kashen asurin, asurim afilu be'ana. When they are restricted, not only are they restricted in eating them, they're also restricted in any hana'ah from them. Kashen mutarim, mutarim afilu be'achila. And when they are mutar, they're completely mutar to the point where you can eat them. I mean, the transition that goes on over here is a difference between something that has the status of stam yenam, which has an iser hana'ah associated with it, versus not being yayin at all. It's now ois yayin, and in a big ois yayin, there's no question. It's not even just mutar bana, it is also mutar ba'achila. I'm Rav Zvid. Haidur daya dechamra darmai. The sediments that are at the bottom of the barrels of the non-Jews, batar treisa yarche shat v'shari. After 12 months, they are mutarim. He's basically saying what we are indicating in the Mishnah, that the leftovers from the gat, the pits, and the skins, after 12 months, they dry out to the point where they're no longer considered to be stam yenam. The same is true with the sediment at the bottom of the barrel that collects there. If they dry out for 12 months, they're no longer problematic. Now, the reason that they would utilize them after 12 months was for kindling or firewood. They would throw them into the ovens to help keep the ovens burning. They were things that burnt quickly and also were good for maintaining the fire. And the truth is that they also added flavor. And that's what the Gemara is focused on, is that they don't want them adding flavor. So it has to be at a point where they're dried out, to the point where they're brittle and they're not going to make any difference in terms of flavoring the item. So here, Bali at Tosafot make an interesting point. Can you simulate 12 months? Which is a problem that comes up in kashrut in general. Like, for instance, when it comes to the salting of meat. The salting of meat has to be done within 72 hours after the shechita. Otherwise, the blood already sets into the meat and you can't get it out, unless you then roast it over an open fire. So the question comes up with, for instance, if they freeze the meat right away within the 72-hour period. So then, biologically, you've slowed down the clock so that the 72-hour period now is extended. On the other hand, you're missing in the first 72 hours, you're not salting it. So the question is the halacha of 72 hours? 72 hours, doesn't matter what the condition of the meat is. Or by freezing it, are you able to extend the 72-hour period? We're generally makpid in order that it be that you do it within the first 72 hours. For many years in Israel, they used to import meat from Argentina, and on the Tudat Kashrut, it used to say Basar Kafoy. Basar Kafoy meant it was frozen at the origins, and then only salted when it was defrosted here when it came to Israel. And that was one of the problems with that meat, and that's why they made sure to mark it on the Tudat Kashrut, that you knew that if you were going to do that, you were using that dispensation. Aside from the fact that also the speed of Shechita and the level of Shechita in Argentina at that time was not so strong. Some people just saw it as being evidence of the fact that the Shechita there wasn't as strong as Shechita, and therefore you could worry about it. Depending on the reason, then if you roast it on an open fire, you might be able to overcome the problem. Then you might be able to obviate the problem. If you think that it's a problem in the quality of Shechita, then obviously roasting it doesn't help you, because you just need better Shechita. Today, there's a serious improvement. All the kashrut organizations are down there now, and do shechita down there, and they've really improved. They take the kashrut in general. Now they salt it immediately and they send it over. I don't think you can find anymore the tudat kashrut that says basar kafui on it. I haven't seen that in years. So now, this is in the reverse. They wanted to know, if you fire up an oven and put the shmarim in the oven and then cook them to the point where they dried out, can you simulate the effect of 12 months? The point of 12 months is that they dry out over a period of 12 months. So now, can you simulate that by putting it in the oven? So here we have a tshuva from Rabbeinu Ephraim. Haya omer ki misvara. He says, logically, shmarim shnit yavshu b'tamur mo'il lehem. The shmarim that are put into the tanur, that should help. Kamo hamtana, the yudbet chodesh. Like waiting 12 months. Umitoch kach. For that reason, itir pat. So odeko chavim shenechmatz. B'shamrei yayin shenechvu b'tanur. He allowed them, after these items had been dried out in the oven, but they were using as kindling in the ovens and then baking bread in that oven. So normally, if you have that type of material in the oven, it flavors the bread, and then the bread is a sur. But he said, now they dried out in the oven already, and since they were already dried in the oven, that's the equivalent of being out for 12 months, and there's no problem anymore, and they do not flavor the item. For Rabbeinu Tam hikpid alav. Rabbeinu Tam said he's absolutely wrong. You look at the end of the Tosfot, he has a little poem where he says, Hamore yorek ben sorer umore, v'ala yorek ruach habore. He says, whoever passes like that is like a ben sorer umore, and the wind of Hashem will be with me, meaning that I'm telling you the halacha is not this way. And his halacha is based on the fact that the Gemara here uses the word durdaya, and does not use the word shmarim. And he says there's a big difference between durdaya and shmarim. What you, Rabbeinu Ephraim, are speaking about is shmarim, and shmarim, the Gemara never gives a heter of 12 months. The Gemara only gives a heter of 12 months with regards to durdaya. And that's what he says. The difference between shmarim and durdaya are temed. Temed is something that we'll bump into later in Masechta, we'll bump into it in Kodashim as well, which is that after they had pressed the grapes and gotten the wine out of the grapes, they used to keep that sediment and all the refuse from the gut, and then they used to run water through it. And when they ran water from it, it absorbed whatever was left of the flavor and the juices from the pits and the skins, and then they would make this called lighter form of wine. It's like a pink wine of sorts. So they would make this lighter form of wine, which then would ferment and create a wine that wasn't a strong wine, but it was something that had like flavored type of water. And that's called temed. And what Rabbeinu Tam says is that shmarim are the sediments or the refuse that's left right after the pressing or they found in the barrel. Durdaya are after you've also run the water over them three times, then you have durdaya. And so what he says, Rabbeinu Ephraim is making a mistake, is he's thinking about shmarim. Shmarim are sediment where you haven't run the water through. When you run the water through, what it does is it takes away all that extra flavor and all that extra item that's in there. And then only then, when you dry them out, does that make it into a thing that it's ois stam yenom? But he says if you just take shmarim, that flavor is still captured inside of them because there's still pieces of grape and there's still flavor of grape in them, and you can't do it that way. And if you put them into tanur, even though you're drying them out, in that process of drying them out, you're now exuding the flavor into the oven. And he said, you made a mistake. There's a difference between shmarim and durdaya in the Gemara. But that also makes this heter of durdaya much more narrow, which is not really speaking about sediment, speaking about these leftovers from the gut that were used over and over again and had water washed through them. Then when they dry out, that's when you can say there's no problem of stam yenom. But if you add shmarim, then what seems to be is that the flavor's trapped in, because in there they're drying out with the item there, and then you burn them afterwards, you're going to burn them with the flavor in there. You need both the fact that they're pressed, you need the fact that they were then utilized three times, washed through, and then dried out. All of those together would give you the right to use it, and he says you don't have that with what you're describing, Rabbeinu Ephraim, and therefore he thinks he's wrong. And now the Gemara says, Amarav Chaviva Breit Rova, Hani Gufe, these clay cheres, Bata Tresha Yarki Shata Sharit. After 12 months, they are mutarim. Amarav Chaviva, Hani Avto Detaye, Bata Tresha Yarki Shata Sharit. These Avto, Rashi says they are, Chemat Meor Av. These are canteens or flasks made out of leather, but that is very thick, because they're called botin. And those, after 12 months, they can be made kasher. Now, even though, generally, when it comes to these flasks or canteens that are made out of leather, we said before that you can actually use them right away. You just wash them out and you can use them, because eino machniso l'kiyum. They don't put them into storage. So the wine never sits in there over a longer duration, and that's why rinsing them out would be sufficient. So what Rashi points out here is that these are avto detaye. These are travelers or merchants that go for long distances. So even though these are not usually put into the cellar, the store, nevertheless, because these people travel for long distances, they end up having the wine in there for a long period of time. Given that, it's not enough just to rinse them out. You need to actually wait the 12 months until they dry out and all the flavor comes out of them. That's what an Abdul Datai is according to Rashi. Bali Tosafot bring Rabbeinu Chananel. The Rabbeinu Chananel translates the word into something in Arabic. But the Bali Tosafot say that the Rabbeinu Chananel suggests here the word Avta is from the word Avatiach. It means from a melon or from a watermelon or a gourd. And basically it was a canteen or a utensil that was made out of a hollowed out gourd. And that's what they're speaking about here, that it needs 12 months to dry out. The Bali Tosafot say there's no way that's what it means, because nobody confuses between Avatiach and a gourd. Galat is a totally different species, and they have nothing to do with each other, so there's no way. Now, they did in their day use gourds, or hollowed out gourds, for utensils, because they would dry them out, and they're solid. The ones that you hang in your sukkah, the dry gourds, they become extremely solid after they had dried out. So that's what they used to use. They don't use watermelons for that purpose, they only use gourds for that purpose, and Ferry says it's wrong. Bali HaTosafot bring another version of this from the Oroch. It says that the girsa is not apto, but rather achto. You can see that the Divrei HaMatzkel, Bali HaTosafot, at the top of the Amud, he says that it was an achto. So he brings the girsa to Aruch that it's an achto, which is mevin, kemach, vasavim, ubisamim, flour, some grasses, spices, bishorin otam bechalav, and then they soak them in milk, umizalfin yayin alav, and then they sprinkle wine on top of it. So that's the problem here, is that they're sprinkling the wine on top of this. So now it makes it into a problem when they have stam yena mixed up in there. That's what the Oroch says. The biggest problem with the Oroch is, why does 12 months help you? After 12 months, why does the yayin disappear? Why is there no problem with stam yena after 12 months? So some say that the reason they put the wine in there was for his preservative. And so then after 12 months, it's no longer useful. It's no longer being a preservative. And so that's why it's not a problem. Or others say that after 12 months, the flavor of the wine is clearly gone from the item, and it has no impact anymore on the yayin. But again, if it kicks it into a problematic scenario, because how could it be that something that has stam yinam in it, all of a sudden becomes mutar after 12 months? Here it's not visible, maybe it's not even flavoring it, according to some, but you have to figure out a reason why after 12 months it would be okay over here. Then the Gemara says, Amar Rav Acha Brei D'Ravika, Hani Portzane Darmai. Rashi over here says, Portzane are psolet shel anavim, the residue or the residual of the grapes, although in other places the Gemara calls Portzani the pits of the grapes. But after 12 months, they are mutarim. The Rabbeinu Chananel says over here, Pershubi Ushalmi Achatzani Vazagim Shishaninu Kilachim Asurim Ba'ana'a Bish Mileu Tamina Bor. That's only when he took them out of the vat that collects the wine. Da'ana Seyayin Achirid the Bor. It doesn't have a status of wine until it goes down into the collection vat. Before that, it does not have a status of wine, and therefore, if you pull the seeds of the zagim and the residue out from up there, that would not have a problem. It's only the stuff that flows through and then drops into the receptacle or the collection vat. Those are the ones that we're speaking about over here. Rav Acha Brei D'Rava, Hanei Gufai Shchimei V'Uchmei, these clay utensils that are red or brown, V'Uchmei and black, Bata Tresa Yarkei Shata Shari. After 12 months, they are considered to be mutarim. Now this is strange, given the fact that Gemara already discussed the different colored clays. Gemara of Chavira, Chani Chatzvei Shchimei, these barrels that are dark red or black, Darmai, came into Balei Tuva, since they don't absorb a lot, Meshach Shechan B'mayim Mutarim, just rinse them out and they're totally fine. So the question is, why is this different than what we said before? Why do you need the 12-month period? So you should know, there's some that leave it out of the girsa entirely. But others just say the type of material here or the type of clay was different, and that's why over here they require 12 months versus there where they only required rinsing out of the item. Or, so even though these are similar or seemingly similar to that what we saw before, we could differentiate in the fact that they are used for kiyum over here. And kiyum, as we've seen before, makes it that you need a different requirement of being mitaher or kashering it, which is you need the 12 months, and it's not sufficient with the shorter duration or the rinse out that you would use in other instances. Tanur Banan. Morius uman mutar. You buy morius from a professional maker of morius, it's mutar. That means that even from a non-Jewish maker of morius, Rashi back on Lamed Aleph on Bet explained what morius was, which is that morius marvin bo kirvei dagim, something that you mix up the innards of the fish in this water or brine we're going to see in a second. Rashi over here says that it's made out, the morius is made by taking the fat of the fish, and then you put it in salt and water, and that causes the fat or the oils of the fish to be exuded into the water, and that creates this morius. So this morius is made of like a fish hash, fish brine type of mixture, which is that you have water and salt that are creating the brine, but the brine is being created by placing in the kirvei dagim, the innards of the fish, and the fats that are there. So now he says, if it's done by an uman, it is mutar. Yehuda ben Gamliel, Amar Mishum Rabbi Chanina ben Gamliel, Av chilek uman mutar. So too, chilek of the uman is also mutar. Rashi over here describes chilek as a type of small fish called a sultanit. And that sultanit of these small fish are generally kosher and not a problem. Now, when they are young, they do not have fins and scales. But when they age, they do have fins and scales. So when they're catching them in the water, they do not have fins and scales, but they grow them later. So the big fear was that the nets that they're catching with would have in them both kosher fish and non-kosher fish. And then the individual would place the kosher fish and the non-kosher fish next to each other. They both look small fish, and you wouldn't know the difference because there are no fins and scales even on the kosher fish, because they only developed them later on. So that was the fear. But he says that chilek of the uman, the one of the professional, that is mutar. Now, in both of these cases, the reason that the uman gets a different status is because he wants to protect his professional reputation. When it comes to some balabayit that is catching these fish and then selling them, he takes whatever looks like that fish, he puts it into the thing, and he sells them. On the other hand, the professional uman wants to keep up his reputation that he's only selling really this fish or this chilek. He first of all recognizes the difference between a chilek and other fish. And number two is he wants his customers to come back, so he wants to give them only chilek. So given the fact that he's protecting his professional reputation, therefore we trust him to only have chilek in the packaging that he's selling to you. So his interests are aligned with our interests. And for him to keep it to be kosher is in his own interest. It's not because he's doing it as a favor. He's doing it because he himself wants to present himself as a professional. And if he mixes in other fish, that would be to the detriment of his business. Given that, we trust him. With regards to the morius, the biggest fear we have the morius is that people are going to add wine to it. Because morius was expensive. Given that it was expensive, we worried about the fact that he would pour wine into it as filler material because he could siphon off some of the morius, sell it, and then replenish it with wine, and then that would be able to sell at a higher price than the wine itself. And so that's what we're worried about, the addition of wine. So what the Gemara is saying over here, that the morius of the uman, he doesn't put wine in there, because again, that's going to either ruin it, or it's going to ruin his reputation, and therefore he won't add wine to it in order to sell it. Now, the Balei Tosfot say, in the Mishnah, the Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim were arguing about the morius, whether it was usur b'anar or not usur b'anar, but everybody said it was usur b'achila, so why is that the case? He says that it has to be that was speaking about morius of the balabayit, where you don't have this protection of the uman, or, we're going to see in a second, it's morius after the first or second time. So then there are other cases where it's asur, and that must be what they're speaking about in the Mishnah. So Tani Abime Breit Rababau, morius uman mutar, he utanila v'hu amala. He brought it down, he brought the breita down, and then on top of that, he said the following. So here we have that the morius of the uman, like we said before, is mutar. But he says, Pam Rishon V'Sheni Mutar. The first and second time it's Mutar. Shlishi Asur. On the third time it is Asur. So Rashi says over here, it's similar to the Temet that we spoke about before. They used to use these innards or fats of the fish over and over again to flavor out the fish hash. The first and second time they're very strong, they're very potent. And therefore you would not add wine to them because that would be to the detriment of the morius. By the time you get to the third run, it's much weaker. And since it's much weaker at that time, then we do worry about him adding wine because it wouldn't be against his interest. My time, the first two runs, where there's a lot of fat and a lot of oil in it, he doesn't have to add wine to make it better. From that point forward, they add wine in order to give it strength, or in order to be a filler, to give it more body in terms of the morius or the fish brine hash that you have over here. So that means that when the uman has a vested interest in keeping it the way it is, then his interests are aligned with us, and we believe him. Now, Rashi said before that morius is not made out of non-kosher fish. Morius was only made from kosher fish. The question over here is not about whether it's a duck tameh or duck tahor. It's only a question of whether wine was added or not added. And here, in the first two runs, where there's a lot of oil or fat in there, that gives it body, it gives it flavor, and the wine would ruin it. So a professional doesn't want to ruin his reputation in selling Morius, and therefore he would not add wine to it. By the third run already, there people would add wine to it, even a professional, and that's why it's problematic from the third run and onward. Now we have a story that sort of corroborates this. How Arba de Moraisa? There was this boat that was carrying Morius on it. The Atele Namila de Akko came into, you can see in Rashi, Namila is Namal Porta, he says the port of Akko. Ote Rabbi Abba de Minako Nature Bahada. Rabbi Abba de Minako set up people to watch the boat from there to forward so that the Morius would remain kasher. So Amarle, we either have here Orovo or the alternate here says Rabbi Abba Adeina Manatra, who was guarding the boat until this point in time. They were on the boat all this time. How do you know they didn't add wine to the Morius? Now you set up guards now to watch the merchandise. So they can't add wine to it. They could have added wine all along. Amale, Adam inna l'may nechushla. Until now, what do we have to worry about? If it's because they're going to mix wine into it, kista de Morius beluma. Kista is a measurement. You could sell the kista Morius for bluma for one shekel or one coin. Kista de chamra bedaludume. And the same measure of wine costs four times as much. So why would you ever add wine into the fish brine? The wine is worth so much more than this Morius. There's no reason to do it. You would not gain by putting wine into it because you're now going to have to sell it for a quarter of the price versus selling the wine outright. So nobody in their right mind is going to put wine into the Morius because they're going to be losing money by doing so. Amarle Rabbi Yirmiyah, the Rabbi Zemra, Dilma Aide de Tzur Atu, Shavi Chamro. Wait a minute, maybe they came south from Tyre. Generally, when they traveled in those days, they tried to stay within eyesight of the shoreline because traveling was difficult and you didn't want to get cast out to sea. You wanted to know where you had to go in case you had to an emergency dock. So they used to keep their eye on the shoreline. So if they're coming here bringing wine, this Morius, from out at sea, they were following the shoreline, they would have passed Tyre on their way south, coming from the north down to the south, hugging the shorelines. Then they would have passed Tyre. And it happens to be in Tyre, which has heavy wine production, that wine was cheaper over there, and wine and Morius were of the same price over there. So in that case, there is a kashash they would dump wine in there, because wine and Morius were the same price. So maybe if they were coming down the southern shoreline, they stopped in Tyre, and then you have a problem. He says there are, a kule means like turns, or winding areas, and pshure means waters that are flowing out, sweet waters that are flowing out to the sea. Which is that over that shoreline from Tyre down to Akko, along the way you bump into a lot of rivers that are emptying out into the sea. And you also bump into a lot of areas where the land is not straight, it moves around. So it's actually very dangerous to run the boat close to the shoreline because of the rivers that are emptying that can push the boat out. And also the problems of the land is not straight. And therefore you capsize in those areas because the areas could be shallower than you think. There are tons of rocks in there. The land, the contours of the land move. So what's going to end up happening is the person's going to stay further out to sea to avoid that problem. But they're further out to sea, that means that they're never really going to dock at Tyre, even though they're coming along the shoreline. Had it been they were hugging the shoreline, they could have stopped along the way with no problem at Tyre without any extra effort. Here where they're already further out to sea because they're avoiding the shoreline, for them to go into port at Tyre and come back out, is a big extra trip, and they wouldn't have done that. And that's how I know that the Morius on here is secure or safe, because the Morius isn't worth as much as the wine. There's no reason they would have poured wine into the Morius. But then once they landed, either now because the wine is cheaper, or now because they might start selling off part of the Morius and then want to refill it, so there we start to worry about what's going on with the Morius. But until this point in time, there was no chashash. And now we move on to the part of the Mishnah which has to do with the cheeses, which is, we're not Beit Onyunke. The cheeses of Beit Onyunke were problematic, and we saw that Rabbi Meir thought there was a problem there. Rabbi Meir says, because the Rov HaGalim, the majority of calves there were given to Avodah Zarah. Why did they restrict the cheeses of Onyunke? Because the majority of calves in that city were Mukrav Avodah Zarah. Mayiriya Rov HaGalim. Why does it matter that it's the majority? Even if the minority of them were given to Avodah Zarah, it would be a problem. We know that Rabbi Meir's opinion is that we worry about minorities. Whenever there is a minority out there, Rabbi Meir says we worry about it. The example that's brought has to do with Yibum. We have a Katan and Katana. Can they perform Yibum? Do we worry about the fact that one of them may be impotent? Because if they're impotent, then there's no mitzvah of Yibum, and then they'll be violating Isur Karet, Minat Torah. So how do we know? We won't know till they grow up. The Chachamim say the rova people are not impotent, and therefore you can have Yibum even if they're a Katan or Katana. Now then, Rabbi Meir says, you gotta wait. He's chayish lemiuta. For that minority of them that are problematic, we're not gonna allow them to get married until they get older, and we know for sure that these individuals can procreate. Gemara explains now. So, Iyamar to Rov, because if you say the majority of calves were used for Avodah Zarah, ikam miut, then you have a minority. Ela Iyamar to miut, if you say only the minority of calves were given to Avodah Zarah, came in the ikam rova galim, de nishchatim laborat kochavim. Since you have the majority of cows or calves that are not used for Avodah Zarah, v'ikanami shar behemot, de'en nishchatim la'avodat kochavim, and then you have the remainder of animals that were not used in the service of the Avodah Zarah, havalei miyuta de'miyuta. It is the minority of the minority, or what we call an improbability. U'miyuta de'miyuta lo chayish Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir is not choshesh for minute probabilities or improbabilities. If it's such a minority, it's a minority of a minority, then Rabbi Meir says, I'm not going to worry about it. Rabbi Meir worries about minorities that are probable or have a significant enough influence over the probabilities that you would say that this miut has significance. But if it's an insignificant minority, he won't do that. So that's why it has to be rov ha-galim. It has to be the majority of calves, because the majority of calves are the majority of all calves there, but they are a minority of all animals that are there that could possibly be there. So then it's a minority with significance. But if you say that it's the minority of calves, which are also the calves of the minority of animals that are there, then you have a minority of a minority, becomes an insignificant number, and even Rabbi Meir would not be chayish for that. Tosfot over here says, even if you have a rov here, why isn't that a miuta de miuta? Because you also have a chazoka that supports it. You have a chazoka that the kebot of these calves beforehand were mutarim. So now you have the kebot that had a chazak heskat hat there. Then you have the minority of calves that are not shechted avodah zarah. Then you have the majority of animals that are not shechted avodah zarah. You combine those, and you made it into a miuta de miuta again. So he says, "Eish lamar the shani hocha the lachar shchita itrale chazaka." Once you've done shchita, you lose the chazaka that you had before. Tana kebot omdot lefenenu lachar shchita b'safek v'dat kochavim chayimi. You can't say that once it shechted that has the chazaka that it was beheter before it was shechted, because you've changed the reality now. When you shechted, that is a new reality, and that new reality is really a safek, and therefore the chazaka doesn't exist. And there you have to look in any case as to whether the chazaka that you're using to support your contention has somehow been altered by the circumstance, like here by shchita, and therefore that chazaka can no longer be added into the mix in order to push it in either direction as to whether it's a rov or a miut. Amalei Rabbi Shim bar Yochim, the Rabbi Shim ben Lakish, tinishkatim levadat kochavim, I have it. Even if they're shechted for avodah zarah, why does that make a difference? Vahat u'dushori. You say when they shecht them levadat zarah, it's not even asur. Person who shechts a animal to be zorek the dam, to sprinkle the dam on the mizbeach of the avodah zarah, or daktir chalba levodat kochavim, or to sacrifice its fats on the mizbeach of the avodah zarah, Yochanan amar asura. Yochanan says it's problematic because zavar mechashvim miavodah levodah. You can have a machshava in one avodah that will impact the other avodah. Ve'ofin en chutz mipnim. And you can learn what is done outside, meaning for avodah zarah, from pnim, what is done in the mikdash. Shemar muteret. Shemalach says it's totally fine, but because he believes that you don't learn chutz mipnim inside the beit mikdash, we're going to get spend a lot of time with this when we get to the gemarot and zbachim. There's a concept of pigul, which means if a person has the wrong machshava, the wrong thought with regards to the kodesh, for instance, he wants to eat it outside of its time period. He wants to sprinkle the dam outside of the normal time period or in a place that is inappropriate. So that's what's called chutz lizmano, chutz leminkomo. That ruins the item. One of the issues that comes up there is mechashvim miavodah levodah. If you check the animal without any ulterior motives, without any problems, but you have in mind to sprinkle the blood outside its time period that it's normally sprinkled, that's called pigul. Which means you're having a machshava and shchita, but something that deals with zrika. You haven't done the zrikat adam yet. You haven't even been involved with it. You're not even having the wrong thought there. Your wrong thought during shchita can impact on the sprinkling of the dam, and it makes the animal into pigul. So the question is, does that have application by avodah zarah? Here he's shechting the animal not for avodah zarah, ejecting the animal for sprinkling its blood to Avodah Zarah. So as far as the Shechita is concerned, the Shechita doesn't have any problem. The Shechita is something that is done with no ulterior motive. But he's thinking about sprinkling the blood to Avodah Zarah, which is a makshava about a different Avodah. So what Rabbi Yochanan says is that's problematic. Just like it's problematic in the Mikdash, it's also problematic in Avodah Zarah. Shimon Lakshi says that's a unique din by Kodesh, that you may have a makshava to makshava. It's a big chiddush. But by Avodah Zarah, there's no reason to believe that that's the case. Therefore, if you shecht it, even though you're going to want to sprinkle the dam to Avodah Zarah, the shechita itself is a shechita kshera, and you can eat the shechita, you can eat that animal. The truth is, by Tosfot asks, how do you know? The Gemara here just spoke about doing shechita to Avodah Zarah. Maybe they just did the shechita, the shame Avodah Zarah. Why does it have to be that they did the shechita for the dam? They said the main reason you shecht an animal is to sprinkle the blood on the Mizbeach, or put the fats on the Mizbeach. Is that mostly the purpose or the intent of the individuals? We're going to assume here it's the same thing. You shechted it in order to sprinkle the dam on the Mizbeach. The shechita in and of itself is not significant. You shechted it to facilitate what comes afterwards. So you think that that's what Oved Kochavim is thinking. And you, Rabbi Shimon Lakshi, say it's mutar. So then how do you have a case here where the calves create a problem if they shechted them to Avodah Zarah? Shechita to Avodah Zarah is not problematic according to you. I hope your mazel is better next time. Tarum, you should be uplifted. Sha'a, your hour. So that's your mazel should be uplifted. Whereas if you look in the Rabbeinu Kanano, he translates Torminach Shateich, perish. Tisautcha Shateich, vidom. Which is more like a criticism which says, I hope your mazel takes you out of here and be silent. And then what you're asking is not really relevant, then you really should be out of here. Whereas Rashi seems to be more like a bracha, that your mazel should grow from here, or your mazel should keep growing from this point forward. Bomer Gmar Zvichahu Obda. That he did it at the end of the Gmar Zvicha, the end of the Shechita. Shechashava Shechita Tzmal Avodat Kochavim. He actually had in mind for the Shechita itself, Avodah Zarah, and he said, Belibo Zvichazu Obda Avodat Kochavim. When he shechted it the shame Avodah Zarah. The only reason Reish Lakish said he did it at the end is because Reish Lakish is of the opinion that ain't Shechita l'basof. So Machloket will see again in the Gemara upcoming whether Shechita is mitchilat sof, is Shechita the whole process, and that's called Shechita, or Shechita l'basof. Only when you finished is that called Shechita, and that obviously has makes a difference as to when you have to have the Makshava. So but here he says, the Gemara Shechita, at the end of the Shechita, that's when Shechita happens according to Reish Lakish. At that point, he had a makshava, the Avodah Zarah, and that's what ruined it. He wasn't thinking about the dam or anything like that. He shechted it, the Avodah Zarah, and that's why there's a problem over here. So Amar Yehuda, Shaul Rabbi Shmuel, Amar Rav HaKodvai Amar Rav, HaMekadesh Perish, Shor Niskal Mekudeshet. Someone who offers his wife the wonderful gift of the rennet, or the waste that is inside the stomach of a Shor Niskal, Mekudeshet, he gave her something of value, that is Kiddushin. The Ferish Egle Obdot Kochavim ain't a Mikudeshit. The other hand, if he uses the rennet or the liquid that is sitting in the stomach of the animal that was shechted to Avodah Zarah, that has no value to it because it's Aser Behana'a. And since it has no value, you can't get married with it and the Kedushin don't go through. What's the difference between them is really the question. It's also true that a Shor Niskal is Aser Behana'a. So why by a Shor Niskal does it work? And by the Shor Avodah Zarah does not work. Ibai de masvari, de makra. Some say it's logical, some say it's a pasuk. Ibai de masvara, that's logical. Gabe egle of dat kochavim, nekale benifnafke. He wants the heft, or the animal to look bigger, because then it looks like he's bringing a bigger gift to the Avodah Zarah, and so that even the perish in the belly, which gives expanse and heft to the animal, that is beneficial. So it's all, in the sense, dedicated towards the Avodah Zarah, because the parish is giving him a service for helping him towards his worship of the Avodah Zarah. And that's why it is a surbana. About Gabi Shorni Skal, Onekalei Benafchei. But the Shorni Skal is indifferent about the parish or how big it is, how small it is. The animal is going to be killed at this point. It's going to be stoned to death. And so he has no interest in the size of the animal. It may even be detrimental, because then the animal might live longer, may take longer to stone the animal. But there, the parish has no value in terms of the shore itself. And that's why it's considered to be separate or distinct from the basar of the animal. And that's not a surbana. Ibai tei makra, some say it comes out of the pasuk. Tevocha, it says, by Avodah Zarah, lo yibak biyadcha meuma min acherim. You're not even to take anything. Any small thing you can't take. So any minute item that is part of the Avodah Zarah is all part of the Avodah Zarah, and it's disqualified. Uchtiv otam, by shor niskal, it says, sako yisakel ashor, v'lo yachelet bisaro. Says that you stone the animal, and you will not eat the meat. Bisaro asur, it's only the flesh of the animal that is asur, Harpersho muteret. On the other hand, its waste is muteret because it's not subsumed under the category of basar. Amar Rava tarvayu taninimu. Same as Benichuta. Both of these are found in the Tanaic work, and he's going to bring it from our Mishnah. And that is because, as the Baal Tosafot point out, sometimes this is a question on the Amora, which is, we already see this in a Tanaic work, what are you saying? But as we're going to see here, it's out of a diuk of the Mishnah, and therefore what he was doing was explaining to you the diuk out of the Mishnah that brings you to this conclusion. And therefore he's bringing this as a support to the statement rather than a question. In the Kamarlei, because the answer that Rabbi Yeshua gave to Rabbi Shmuel was, Yibnei Shema Amidim Bekebat Nevela, that they used to curdle the cheese in the stomach of a nevela, isn't the stomach of an ola more chamur than the stomach of a nevela? And then he said the Kohanim were able to drink the perish that was inside the stomach of a ola. If it can be done by an ola, then certainly it can be done by a nevela. Michlau de isurei hana'a shoru pershayu. There you see that even though something's asur b'hana'a, that the perish that is associated with them is mutar. Now nevela is not asur b'hana'a, it's only asur b'achila. But an ola is not only asur b'achila, it's also asur b'hana'a. Despite the fact the Kohanim were drinking that which was found in the stomach. And his answer to him is, because they curdled the cheese in the stomach of the animals that were dedicated to Avodah Zarah. And then, and then he answers him, then why did they make it asur b'ana'a in that case? There you see that the kebab, the avodah zarah, it's curled the milk there, that it's problematic. What you see from the conversation between Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Yeshua is that as Rabbi Yeshua answers Rabbi Shmuel, the answers that he gives him are responding to what he's saying. He's asking, why is it asur b'achila for the chachamim? Jesus, a beidon yoke. And he answers him, because they curdle them in the stomachs of a nevela. Then the response there of Rabbi Ishmael is, what are you talking about? The rennet, or the leftovers that are found in the stomach of the cow that's an ola, are mutarim. The Kohen's allowed to gulp that down as long as he's not so particular, he can gulp that down. What that shows you is that there's a heter hana'a, not only a heter hana'a, but even a heter achila in that case, that's associated with these stomachs. That means the perish in the nevela and the perish in the ola is considered to be mutar and totally fine. On the other hand, when it comes to the avodah zarah, in response to that, Rabbi Yeshua says to Rabbi Shmuel, well, that's because it came from avodah zarah. And then Rabbi Shmuel says, well, what came from avodah zarah? Why are the chachamim only osur b'achila? They should be osur b'hana'a. That shows you that he believes the perish of avodah zarah is asur b'hana'a. So you see the two sides of the puzzle here. V'lahadalei mishum d'ha'arite the isura b'enei. Why does he just answer him that the isur is not extant? Da morius, the rabbanon, delo asura behana'a. When it comes to morius, which is mentioned in the Mishnah, that the chamim only make an asur b'achila, or shtia, not asur b'hana'a. My time, what's the reason? La bishum delet to the isura b'enei. Because in the fish brine hash, the actual wine that's in there is no longer extant, no longer visible. So that's why asur b'shtia, but mutar b'hana'a. Why don't you say the same thing here by avodah zarah? Which is, the reason it's asur b'shtia is because the item is no longer around. You're just dealing with the rennet and the curdled cheese that came from it. The curdled cheese doesn't have the item in it. The curdling is done, but as a mamid, it's something that the enzymes that are there trigger the curdling of the cheese. But they themselves are not found in the cheese. So since it's not in the cheese itself, why don't we say it's fine? Say, hey, mirahach, it came into ukme kamukim, koshele kamanda itte l'isure v'enei. This is something we spoke about when discussed it by the Mishnah, which is that when you have something that causes curdling, but there's something that's so integral to the creation of the item, it becomes a part and parcel of the item, even though it's not in the item. So for instance, se'or, when you're dealing with sourdough, or you're dealing with yeast that makes the bread rise, even though the yeast or the sourdough itself is not in the bread itself, and it's not necessarily even flavoring the bread, it causes a process to start with the dough that you have there. That process, since it was triggered by that item, even if it doesn't have a tom in it, nevertheless, since it's so essential or integral to the process, it's considered as if it's in it. And that's true by so'or, and that's also true by over here, by the curdling of the milk, that the perish, or the rennet that's there, is the cause for that to happen. And since it's the cause, even though it's not the flavor, it is still considered as if it's in it, or it's ibn, and therefore it makes it asur. So that's why he didn't answer him that way, because that wouldn't have been a good answer. It's a ma'amid, and a ma'amid has the status as if it's flavoring the item, even though it doesn't. So since it causes the curdling, it's as if it's in the cheese still, and that's why it'd be a sur. And that's why he asked them from Avodah Zarah, and that's the question of Rabbi Shmuel, and that's why Rabbi Yeshua did not answer him with that answer that is equivalent to Morius, because it's different than Morius. Morius doesn't have anything that makes it into what it is, or is essential to making it into what it is. Okay, we'll stop here by the two dots, the top of Lamed Hei Amud Aleph.